Hi, welcome everybody to concurrent session 3E. Just to check you're in the right room. It's intriguingly titled All R's and No Action. And we're going to be looking at rehabilitation, retraining, reskilling, redesign and repricing, impacting the life insurance and the reinsurance markets. Start with a little bit of housekeeping as per the other sessions you've attended. A reminder to please complete the presenter feedback forms. Also, there'll be a session 10 to 15 minutes at the end for questions. Please use the microphone for questions. Please announce your name. And for some of my ex-colleagues, please keep it quite concise so we can get as many questions from the floor. Some introductions to the speakers. Firstly, Andrea McDonnell. Andrea is a client director in Aon's health and benefits business. Her primary role is providing strategic, tailored solutions for employers and superannuation funds in relation to design and financing of their death and disability benefits. Andrea's held consulting roles in both Australia and the UK and is a member of ASFA's Insurance Standing Advisory Panel and Insurance Diploma Unit Committee. Also speaking, we have Jan Sun. Jan is director and life actuary working in Aon's Asia Pacific life reinsurance team based in Singapore. Her role includes providing strategic advice with tailored reinsurance solutions for life and superannuation clients across Asia Pacific in relation to structuring and designing optimal risk transfer solutions in a highly dynamic market landscape. So, over to you.
Thanks, Ashley. Right, we might have got a bit carried away with the no action, but that was just to interest you a little bit more. So this talk actually follows on from a talk that Jan and I gave 2 years ago at the last Financial Services Forum. So I'd just like to take you back 2 years. And at that time, there was a lot of turmoil in the group insurance market, and that was largely because both reinsurers and insurers had made huge losses because the experience that was being faced was not what had originally been priced. So I'm not going to go through the detail of this slide, which actually came from that presentation, but as you can see, the emerging reality at the time was quite different. And one of the things in particular Jan will cover is looking at some of those new risks that were arising. So at that time, we had an urgent call to action. There were, for instance, the need to change definitions for TPD. We've actually seen quite a bit of change there. To take away selection by tightening up eligibility and charging more. So we saw premium increases as a result. So really what we've seen since that time, there's been a lot of change. So there's been a lot of focus on those terms and conditions and the actual product itself. But really where we see ourselves now is that whilst we've had those changes, we've started to put the puzzle together, there's still quite a few pieces missing to make sure that we have a sustainable product that actually works for all the individuals that we are covering. So I'll just pass over to Jan to continue, and I'll speak with you later.
All right. Same problem. Can't reach. Everybody hear me? So actually, what's really, really good about, actually, before I start, this slide here, I just want to sort of take us back to some of the things that's happened in the past. And one of the items that I will touch a bit more on is some of the newer risks. In particular, some of these risks that's actually taking over the cancers and the heart disease that we've traditionally seen that's kind of you know, send us to our graves. So I will focus a bit on that. And the overriding theme is in 2014, we had to react very quickly. Life insurance policies guaranteed renewal. So you've got to give a price. You've got to fix what you can. And you've got to do it very quickly. So I think what we've done is we've tightened eligibility very quickly. Windows are gone. We've charged more very quickly. That'll solve part of the problem. We even thought about that. Didn't work, but we tried. And we did a bit of that, but lawyers did a bit more of that. But again, not necessarily a bad thing. But I think what we did, you know, when we were really quick to call for action, we picked at the low-hanging fruits. You know, charge more. Let's make some money for our parents, you know, both local and potentially offshore. And let's fix what we can. And I just ended. Oh, there we go. Fix what we can. That was the end. But I think what we're going to take everybody through today, hopefully, is around what more we should be doing. Yeah. So again, missing some pieces to the puzzle. Courtesy of my friends in French/Oz, that's pulled from one of their reports. So thanks, Gore. I think I'd like to just raise some awareness here. So mental health illness. Again, we talked about some of the emerging themes that's happening. Cancers used to kill us, you know, 10-15%, maybe more. But due to, I guess, some of the medical advancements, it's the mortality, morbidity rates are coming down. Similarly, heart disease, that used to kill us more, but it's not thanks to, I heard a talk earlier. It's again, medical advancements, early screening. So what's coming up now? Mental health. I think as actuaries, particularly pricing actuaries, we've probably seen that coming up more and more in the claims files. Depression, anxiety, bipolar, they're all things that we're starting to see a lot more. And it's something that we've seen globally. What's really, really interesting about this fact from Canada is that some of the diseases that we've probably used to be seeing, like cancer, it can lead to serious depression. Yeah. So, again, it's an emerging theme, and it's something that it's coming up globally. United States, bipolar, more than 2 million American adults. In France, again, it's 40% of permanent disability. It's a global issue. And it's something that's happening in Australia. I mean, again, claims data, we've seen 20-30%, maybe even more, depending on the industry that we're in. White collar, lawyers, financial services firms. Rings a bell, right? We've all done those renewals. What have we decided to do about it? Okay, so coming back to the low-hanging fruit theme, right? What have we decided to do? Before going there, that's another great chart. So I think what's happening here is it's also affecting our capacity for work. So this is more of a monetary value, which I think my colleague Andrea will talk about the impact of this perhaps at workplace. Yeah. So, what have we decided to do about it? So before we get to here, in the Australian market, in some of the renewals, a lot of it has been around, let's just exclude it. Easiest. Yeah, let's exclude it. Let's restrict the benefits. It's non-objective, so let's make it objective. Let's just not pay them. And pretend it's not a thing, but it is. So, and that's something that I think we, as an industry, need to really think about when we just say, well, let's put in a mental health exclusion, you know, because again, there are real people, real claimants, real people behind it. And it's not homogeneous. So it's not the same thing. Yeah. Again, I mean, I'm not a medical expert here, but it's something that we need to think more broadly before just thinking let's exclude it. There are other areas that we can explore. This is a slightly better exclusion. So rather than a full-blown exclusion, this is one we've seen from the French market. So what it's trying to do, it's trying to make it a bit more objective. So what's trying to say here is it's excluded. And again, I can't pronounce some of these words, but, you know, $20 if anybody can. Here too. But the key thing is, you know, it's trying to make it objective by saying you've got to be 15 continuous days admitted into some form of guardianship or hospital or clinic. And what that's trying to do is making it a bit objective. Yeah? You can't just fill out a claim form, find a GP and say that you're unable to work due to a depression. It forces you to seek help, yeah? And hopefully that allows you to return to work earlier, less claims cost if it's a GSC claim, for example, bring you back to work and contributing back to the society. So it's all good things. But that being said, I did hear from a couple of French reinsurers that looked at some claims. A couple of investment banks sacked a lot of people. A lot of depression claims come about. So, okay, so they went to the hospital, right? But it's, south of France, pretty nice hotel. It's like a holiday, So I think, exclusions, it's not the best thing. Trying to make something that's not so objective, perhaps isn't, doing good. It might just bring up some other negative things that we didn't foresee. But that being said, I think as an industry, we need to do something about it. And again, that's where my colleague will come back to this point later on about what we can actually do to help the claimants. And in parallel, hopefully affecting positive parts of the experience. Yeah. So another thing that we've done during the 2013-14 market dislocation. TPD claims have gone up. What do? We tighten it. We change it. We can't exclude it because, CISAC says we have to provide it, so can't exclude it. Thank you, CISAC. The key thing here is I think what we've done here is we've created this shades of gray or multiple shades of gray around tightening the TPD definition by, putting words like retraining in there without really thinking about what that actually means. Again, and Andrew will come back later on to really put the tangible side of what this means. But when we tighten the TPD definition, we just kind of throw this retraining word in without, So I'm just going to take you through the couple of shades of gray, not as sexy as the movie. I just used that word in a actuarial conference. Go me. Selective retraining. So we've seen that before. It's part of our corporate policies for GSC. Certainly some of the other corporate policies that's got a GSC and TBD combo. It can help TBD as well. So that's one aspect, selective retraining, and that usually involves the employer. Compulsory retraining. So our workers' conference have used that as dictated by law, state law. And it's something that I think we've seen recently in a new product that's launched by a fairly large fund. There's a relatively compulsory retraining component to it. There's the majority of the market, no retraining. It just says based on your past experience and education, if you can't work in any jobs, then, here you are as a lump sum. And then what's emerging around the new products, we've got capacity for retraining, this ETER. We give you an ETER, we give you a discount. Hey, great. What does it mean? There's a lot of R's in there, and that kind of links back to our title, right? All R's and no action, or very little action. This R. Well, for starters, there's way too many R's. Reasonably, retraining, rehabilitation could reasonably undertake. I don't think anywhere in here requires the insurer or the fund to make the members go through retraining. And I'm competing against somebody here. And clearly there's also, no element around access to retraining. It's just a blanket definition. Some of the products that I've seen, if you've got the capacity for retraining to go into another job, you are denied a TBD claim. And sometimes we put a minus 10% price tag, minus 15% price tag. And trustees, some of them take this definition on. But what does that mean for the claimant? Do we care whether if the claimant has access to retraining? Do we care if the claimant lives in the middle of nowhere and it's a couple of hundred kilometers away from the nearest, physiotherapist? Reasonable. What does that mean? Can I assume that, he can catch four trains in a bus and walk, 20 kilometers? Can he actually walk, right? And so what does that mean? Capacity for retraining, reasonable. I don't know. So some days as actuaries, we kind of go, here you are, definition, here's 15% discount. We've looked at the claims, and that's what we think. But I don't know. There's some part of the responsibility that's missing here. Here's another one that's popped up. TPD in stages. I've been told, I think we've got to be fairly careful to call it TBD installments, otherwise it's something else. So TBD in stages. This is what we are starting to see in the market, where you're breaking down the lump sum into perhaps multiple stages of TBD. So normally what it says is you'll get parts of your lump sum if you meet a TBD definition, and then you'll get a subsequent part in time. Yeah, in time, if you continue to meet the TPD definition. And again, these, in formal opinion, we will regard as a factor, including but not limited to any rehab, retraining, reskilling that has been undertaken by the time we form our opinion or could reasonably be expected to be undertaken. Again, these reasonable words, reasonably, right? But again, I think it's something that's tighter. We put a price tag to it. People are using this definition, but again, what about the claimant? Who's helping them with that element, right? And I think something that's perhaps untested, right? We if you think the lawyers were a bit evil by raising awareness to valid claims, if they get hold of some of these and challenge reasonable, I'm just throwing the questions out there, yeah. So, I don't think we can answer some of these questions today. Should the fund be taking some of the ownership around the retraining, the reskilling, ensuring that, the members have access to these things that they've, assessed them for in the TPD definition? It's a for-profit supporting non-for-profit sector. So should our insurance companies that's currently insuring these things be footing part of the bill? There is a cost versus benefit element as well. If at the end of the day, the person is, 63, for example, very close to retirement, is the cost worth the benefit, right? Because retraining comes with a cost. And we need to allow for capacity or their fitness for retraining. And I should probably add a word here, access to retraining. Yeah. So some of the parts that I've seen in some of the recent repricing or renewal exercise, A lot of the emphasis is around additional decline rates in relation to the TBD definitions. And it's very easy to put a price tag on that because it's a tougher definition. You're not actually perhaps helping the claimant in the rehabilitation or reskilling part, so you don't consider the cost of it. But what if we do consider the cost? And in particular, some of these costs, if these members want to access retraining, that's some of the costs that they're looking at. Yeah. So, now, again, I mean, this is just an example for illustrative purposes. An example of a recent product that's got a TPD in stages and some of the cost elements that you need to consider to perhaps offset some of the decline rate assumptions that you might be using. So, for example, there will be an element from, say, 200 claims. There will be an element of claimants who would not be fit enough for rehabilitation. And that's some of the, you know, more severe. You know, it's hard to make a claimant go through retraining if they're missing limbs. So that's an assumption you've got to make. There's an element of not follow through. So, for example, if you break your TBD down into various stages, there are some members who's just simply went, well, you know what, I will go and seek other jobs or alternatives, or I am better. Yeah, so there's an element of not follow through. And then that would be the remaining who would be TPD in that stages. You know, the ones that you put them through the capacity for retraining and the reskilling, hoping that they will return to work. Couple of things, early intervention costs. These are some of the costs that I've seen for an initial assessment, including medical. It could be, you know, physiotherapist. It could be an occupational therapist. But that's something in the ranges per cases. And then there are the ongoing rehab costs. Again, this depends on what are the treatments that you require and what ailment you've got. But that's generally minimum amount of hours that they would need to be put through for ongoing rehab costs. There are the routine medical checkups. So the total estimated costs on these, again, rough estimates, yeah? Please don't put this in your pricing report. Rough estimates, the total cost would be this amount. If the premium is roughly, say, 50 million, the total cost is 2 to 3%. Now, it's not an insignificant part to put a claimant through rehabilitation and reskilling and to pay for it as well. So, you know, I understand the costs and I understand why some of the funds and or employers are just using the ETER definition without actually putting a, footing the bill for the costs. So it's not insignificant, but I think it's something that is achievable. And it's something that we can factor into the cost because I think the claimants, there are genuine proportion of claimants that want to be retrained and want to be reskilled. Nobody wants to sit at home to do nothing, right? And overall, I think perhaps the industry may be able to afford it. I've worked in Asia. I've seen some of the horrible, worst products, whole of life. You know, if you have an experience like that, you have that forever. It's whole of life. We're so fortunate that we're in a group insurance market with flexibility to go to annual re-rates, right? I've never seen profitability restored like that quickly. So perhaps the industry can afford it. And clearly every member is different. Just to whack a capacity for retraining and reskilling is something that does not allow for these members different situations. I know to us pricing actually some days it's just an age, you know, a gender, and then off you go, right? Here's a price. But to the funds, and you know, ultimately our clients, to the members, they are individuals. They're not, it's not just group insurance with a unique member ID. And I think as an industry, we can do a lot more to try to allow for these. If Haley loses her job, right? well, okay, if Hayley looks like that, she can be a model. But, I mean, but let's assume Hayley don't look like that. But if Hayley lost her job, right, she's got 45 years in her, sorry, if Hayley has some ailment and is unable to work, she's got 45 years left in her working career. As a fund, as an industry, what should we do to help Hayley? What kind of reskilling and rehab, you know, should we refer her to, right? Phil, yeah, bit disgruntled, middle age, perhaps, you know, less obviously fit, 10 years left in the working career. What kind of support can we provide him, right? Jay, close to retirement, perhaps that's where we do just pay him the lump sum. Yeah, and there are, you know, again, I mean, these are buckets. We're not saying this is individual life insurance, but even in group insurance, it's not just a number or a unique member ID. It's, you know, there are segments that require different things. Our clients are thinking about it. The funds are thinking about it. I challenge the life insurers and the actuaries to think about a bit more before we just whack a discount on decline rate. So, Andrea, I'll bring Andrea back to talk about what might us as an industry help to do about it. Yeah. Thanks, Andrea.
Thanks, Jen. So I'll just like take a sideways step right now, because what I spend a lot of my life doing is working with corporate employers in the who have salary continuance policies. And we've got a whole range of how these insurance policies operate and how the employers actually react and work with the policies. But what I'd really like to talk about is the ones that work the best. And when I say they work the best, they're the employers where we've seen negligible premium increases. We've seen very small need for having to change the sort of tighten the terms and conditions, so maybe minor changes. And just really looking at the reasons why that is the case. So generally what we find is that those cases have somebody who's responsible for looking after all of the elements of the insurance. So firstly, we generally find that we would have absences being reported within 2 weeks of somebody. So once somebody's been off for 2 weeks and it's becoming evident that they're not going to return, they'll get reported to the insurer at that stage, so that an early view can be made as to whether there may be some rehabilitation or assistance to help those people get back to work. We review the position of all of the claimants. Every 2 weeks, maybe a month, depends on the size of the client. We basically have a triage situation where we have the employer and the insurer, so it's the employer who's the policy owner, working with an independent partner to consider what are we doing the best thing for all of the claimants that are actually in train. We have somebody at the employer who is we basically have employers who are willing to offer roles for people to come back part-time if that needs to be to occur, or also in partial capacity. So that's often one of the most difficult things to end a claim. And then finally, another key aspect is that the employer is maintaining contact with that individual when they're away from work. So they feel like they belong, they feel like they have somewhere to return to, and that somebody else is sort of going through the journey with them. So obviously all of those things can't work when we're talking about a superannuation fund, and particularly not a superannuation fund where we only have TPD and no salary continuance. But really what I would say is that there are many aspects that we can use. And I guess firstly, is there a way that we can treat the disability as if there was a GSC insurance in place? So even though that insurance isn't there, how can we actually get there and find out early that somebody isn't able to work? We've already talked about the payment in stages of TPD, but we know that it's very key to be able to be doing something very early. Maybe there's an incentive payment when somebody isn't unable to work, even if they don't know at that stage if it's likely to be permanent or not. The fact that they're doing some reporting so that there's an analysis that can be made as to whether that individual may ultimately become a TPD claim, and if that's the case, is there something we can do about it now? Is there a way to partner more with our allied health groups? So again, to assist with that rehabilitation, to assist with retraining, and also, importantly, it can be hard that, as I was saying, the having those roles for people to come back to when they can't do the job they were doing before, but they can come back in some capacity. How do we find those roles? Sometimes it's often hard. We do know with our smaller employers, it's that they're so small that to have a role, keep a role open for the individual is very difficult. And often we find that they do get put off the books very, very early. When we're talking about a big industry fund, maybe there's a way we could have a pool of jobs, a way that other employers in the fund could assist in providing roles. Ultimately, what I'm suggesting is that what we're doing here, and Jan's been alluding to it as she's been talking as well, that this is all about the individual. So we're here to provide a benefit, and ultimately many of these people have long careers, long potential careers ahead of them, and it may not be in what they were doing before. But what are we doing to actually assist with the individual? So I'm very interested in hearing what people's ideas are about what more we can do. I would suggest that one way that funds can start is to focus on the large employers that they have in the funds. Often these employers will have salary continuance policies, and they will be keen to partner with you to get the best outcomes.
Thank you both. So we've got a good 15 minutes to hopefully do a bit of challenging of what you've heard and get some questions. I may just kick a couple off and please start thinking of some questions on the floor. Maybe for you, Andrew, I was interested in the points you were making here about kind of the amount of stakeholders involved in the problem. You've got the super funds, regulators, employers, the individuals, insurers, reinsurers. I mean, is there kind of a lack of ownership here? Who's ultimately responsible for the best outcome of the end user?
So, is that, yeah, we can hear it. So ultimately, if we're talking about the super, superannuation fund, then clearly the trustee is the one who has the overall ownership and responsibility. But of course, what we're seeing now are many, it's really a partnership now that the insurer and the funds have. What I believe is really important is to bring the employers into the equation. But ultimately to make sure that the key focus is on the individuals themselves. Ultimately, though, what we see is that it needs one individual who's there making sure that all the components are coming together. So what we've seen so far is many good initiatives to ensure the sustainability, but who's actually thinking about bringing it all together and making sure that all the components of insurance of everybody who's involved is leading to the most appropriate outcome.
Can we open up to the floor? Start with announcing your name.
Sure. That's obviously loud. It's on. Lisa Simpson. I'm from PwC. I come from the workers' compensation side of the world, but I also started in life insurance. So thank you both for your perspectives. I do have a question, just an idea to throw out there as well. Because part of my research, I work in a number of different schemes, is actually comparing the effectiveness of the different benefit designs in different jurisdictions. One of my colleagues did a piece where she looked at the return to work outcomes and the health outcomes for injured workers who go through different benefit pathways, comparing people who stayed in a weekly compensation periodic benefits scheme versus someone who had access to a commutation of their entitlement, like a lump sum payment, versus someone else who went down common law routes. Now, the return to work and return to health outcomes are best for someone who stays in a periodic payments system, it turns out. The other systems require some adverse sort of environment with litigation or the requirement to prove that you're disabled. And by the very nature of the product name, total and permanent disability, you label yourself as a disabled person. And it's very hard in that environment to actually get someone engaged in retraining. If they know they have to be disabled in order to be entitled to a lump sum, that changes the whole neuroscience of the claim and the environment. So the big bold proposition I put out there is, why aren't super trustees saying, I want a product that looks like a workers' compensation product and doesn't have lump sums? It actually supports my workers to get back to work when they're injured or retrain if they have to, but it doesn't give them this big lump sum at the end so they don't invest in being disabled. So for workers' comp for non-work-related injury and mental health.
Well, I'm not going to plug that product, but SunSuper just did that effectively. That's what that was. So it was great that you've just raised that. That's one element that's happening out there versus some of these other big funds that just gone to the ETER without really thinking about what these additional declines, what those claimants are doing. So again, I think that's a great product and it's in the right direction. But that being said, similarly, right, there are major funds out there who has a default GSC fund with very minimal TPD lump sum. Whatever the CIS minimum is, they offer that. But they have a to age 60 or to age 65 income, but that income isn't related to 75% of your salary, because that would be, again, some of the issues around, you know, if you give somebody such a high amount, would they return to work? But they actually give the average of the, somebody, I think the amounts are very heavily pegged to the average of the salaries in Australia, like $3,000 or $4,000 a month, depending on the age, right? So there are good funds out there. There are products out there. I think there's not enough of it going that direction because it's too hard. It's perhaps, not easy to administer if you're moving to a stage base. And I say, or some of the life insurers are saying, it's untested, so, unsure operations. I mean, there's a whole host of things why they're not moving there. But there are a couple of good funds out there that are already heading and already in that direction.
Yeah. And I'll just add to that. And, of course, one of the old-style benefits that we had in funds many years ago was a TSE benefit, which was available to everybody, and then generally at the end of 2 years, if it turned out that it was clear somebody was never going to go back to work, they would then get the lump sum benefit. So that had many, many good aspects to it. But the point that you make, I mean, at the end of the day, what people are used to is an income, and you can keep things as much as to what they're used to and in line with their needs if you're providing an income to actually meet those needs, and then just recognising that in some cases when somebody is, extremely disabled, then there's the case for the lump sum. But I liked also how you mentioned the workers' compensation, and one of the things, again, that we find works very well when working with employers, when we have those meetings to review claims and what's happening with individuals, it will mirror and also potentially be including workers' comp, because some of those claimants will be on workers' comp claims as well. So there are many lessons that can be learned, and I think one of the outcomes of sort of changes to legislation was the big fog as well. TPD is compulsory. You have to do that, and I think we sort of jumped in. Well, TPD benefits, oh, they should be the same level of death benefits, without giving too much thought to that.
Hi, my name's Adrian. I'm from Swiss Re. I sort of just want to defend ETR as a concept. Only on the idea that most TPD claims are, you know, notified 2-3 years down the track. And coming from a workers' comp rehab background, you can't really rehabilitate people at that point. And your example probably was talking about claim size of about 200 grand, which isn't really the industry fund space, and then say 10 grand on rehab. And I sort of think in those situations, what you're actually trying to defend is, in workers' comp, if you go down the stream of different job, different employer, you'd probably still meet the TPD definition in the past, but you now wouldn't meet it in the future, and you actually now have a job. So a lot of the work for the rehab is actually done in workers' comp, and I think sometimes we sort of think that works with our life insurance, but it's actually, we need to actually think about what the workers' comp's already been done. So it's more of a comment, but I sort of feel like ETR has its point, because it's trying to actually look at claims where people may have already been rehabilitated. Having come from a workers' comp background, I understand that when they're trying to get people off on the old Section 40 assessments, they actually would, if someone lived in a remote location, you couldn't really get them off, because it wasn't really reasonable to expect them to do rehab. So I imagine in a legal challenge, I'd probably agree that probably wouldn't be reasonable.
Cheers. No, I'm sorry. I wasn't gonna, you know, be negative on ETER. It was just he told me to be controversial, so I had to pick at something. I can't pick at him. No. I mean, again, I think you're right. It's got its place, particularly for, as you say, sometimes people have been retrained and rehabilitated already, and they claim, you know, 3 years later, and yeah. So no, I agree. But that being said, on your earlier point on whether retraining and rehabilitation works 2 years or 3 years, and whether that's got any effect to return to work, I think it does. I mean, IAD, I don't know what's the number, 85, 87, 89 says so, right? I mean, we use that, we use it. So while the probabilities are small, or whether they're right or wrong, but we do use it. People, you know, in our pricing assumptions, our reserving assumptions, we assume there's an X percent of these people that are returned to work. Sometimes TPD is cyclical. There's a big economic factor, just because, that they're not, that they report a claim late doesn't mean that, you know, if they've been reskilled, economic scenarios change, they're not more motivated to come back to work. So, yes, again, shades of grey. but yeah, I do take your point. Yeah, it's not all bad.
Closer, Mike Murphy. Just following up a comment about superannuation fund and a Sun Super product, which I'm unfamiliar with, but the restrictions around superannuation funds, as I understand it, is you can't pay a benefit period for longer than a two-year period and get a tax deduction on the premium, and you can't pay a benefit for longer than a two-year period and get the benefit at all out of a super fund. Am I correct in those restrictions? And so the discussion on best way of handling disability is really it's an outsider super thing rather than inside of super?
Well, I guess one of the ways that, and you do need to be very careful about the legislation, as you point out, one of the ideas of sort of paying over a longer period is really, can you determine when somebody is TPD? And really, I think the better option is to go with your temporary disabled until you're absolutely certain. So, temporary disablements can be paid, I mean, as long as somebody is temporarily and ceased, so basically becomes a total and permanent disablement. No, that's my understanding. So long as they actually are still temporarily disabled, you just can't pay them more than what they were earning before they became disabled.
Land. I've come up through the life insurance and superannuation streams, but I'm very interested in the workers' compensation and rehabilitation, which has been alluded to. And the background of why I'm interested is I've dealt with a number of superannuation fund trustees. Trustee said, why are we trying to reinvent all these R's, as you say, when we've already got this workers' comp set up for 20 years, and they've got relationships with the employers, they've got all the allied services, they've got everything there. Everything you're talking about developing is already there. So we did a piece and actually went and talked to them. And yes, and they're saying, well, there's no difference to a claim whether it happened at work or outside work or whether it's a lump sum or income. So I just had a question in relation to that. Are we seeing anything in the market in relation to sort of integrating those services or even having commercial arrangements between the life insurers and the rehab providers in workers' comp?
You just have 1 minute on that answer.
Well, it does happen to some extent in the employer space. So many of them employers do want to be working with those same rehabilitation companies that they're already working with on workers' comp, and there's been agreements to do the same with the life insurers. So I think you're right, it could go a lot further in making that work. And yeah, my point being that that link with the employer is very important, and there's more opportunity.
Okay, well, thank you everybody for your participation and questions, and please join me in thanking Andrew and Jan for their presentation.